Welcome. At the King Center on International Development at Stanford University, I am joined by Sumitra Jha, Associate Professor of Political Economy at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Today, we will discuss the drivers of Hindu-Muslim conflict. Sumitra, welcome.
Thank you. Such a delight to be here.
Okay, great. Tell me, what is your theory of peaceful inter-ethnic cooperation?
So, I've been very interested in how economic ideas or economic relationships can foster peace. And you might think that this is a obvious thing, at least as old as Montesquieu, where he argues that the commerce makes people soft. You know, the basic idea is you don't want to fight people that you do trade with because you're going to lose the future stream of trade. But then, you know, we've seen numerous examples throughout history where, you know, market-oriented minorities have actually been the targets of violence. I mean, in Europe, you can think about the South Asians in East Africa or the Chinese in Indonesia. So one question that, you know, I wanted to understand is, under what conditions can, you know, business relationships and trade and commerce really bring peace, and when does it lead to violence instead? And so, you know, I began to look at Indian history going all the way back to the beginnings of Islam, because, as you know, Muslims came to India as traders, you know, in the early years of Islam itself, and tracing kind of travelers' narratives, contemporary sources all the way up into, and you know, a lot of data from the modern period, it became kind of clear that there were really three conditions that were necessary for these inter-ethnic relationships to really lead to peace. One of them was that you should have complementarity. That, you know, if you're both competing, on the other hand, you know, there's going to be an incentive over time to get rid of the other group, particularly if they're a vulnerable minority, because, you know, then you can basically monopolize or do better. So, ironically, you know, in economics, we often think, well, the more time you have, you know, you can get the, we have folk theorems that suggest people can get along, but if you're competing with a person over time, then, you know, you might have the opposite effect, because it's better to get rid of them now, because you have this future of less competition to look forward to.
Can I just say one thing?
Please.
I have this exact theory about why economists are so nice to me, because I'm not an economist, so I'm not competition in any sense, but I've got this complementary knowledge. So yes, let's bring Alison on and chat to her. So I totally think that what economists are nice to me for precisely your theory.
It could be true.
Anyway, please continue.
But, you know, on the other hand, you know, if you're the only one producing left-hand shoes in a world where everyone produces right-hand shoes, you know, there really is a gain from trade, from interaction. And so, and that, you know, that can induce some peace. And in fact, in the Indian Ocean, you know, because of the Hajj and the pilgrimages inherent to Islamic doctrine, One month every year for close to 1,000 years, Makkah was the largest market in the world at a certain moment in time. You know, this induced a really big advantage for Muslims in overseas trade. And this was not just on the Indian coast. This is true in the coast of East Africa, mm-hmm. going through Indonesia, all the way up to China. So Muslims dominated Indian Ocean trade and commerce. So at these places where Hindus had to interact with Muslims in order to tap this massive market, you know, these medieval ports began to emerge. And what was, I think, interesting is that it being a large trading network, you know, it was hard to seize or expropriate. It wasn't like the Muslims had land that could be stolen. It wasn't like Muslims had machines that could be seized. Even human capital can be replicated over time. The fact that it's a really large trading network meant it was intangible, and also the Hajj was at such a large scale that, you know, even a whole large set of Hindus could not be able to replicate it. So there was like this robust complementarity between Hindus and Muslims. And in fact, you know, I think one example that I found pretty compelling during my fieldwork was the town of Somnath, which is, of course, this famous temple town off the coast of Gujarat, where, you know, it's famous in India because it's often seen as the kind of moment where Hindus and Muslims hated each other ever since. So, you know, in 1026, Mahmud of Ghazni, an Afghan cavalryman, comes down into Somnath and sacks the town and kills a large number of people. And Al-Biruni, well, his book is on my shelf somewhere, but he was with him, and he's writing in 1030 that this led to this this hatred between Hindus and Muslims that have lasted ever since. But Romila Thapar, famous Indian historian, and others have kind of documented how in Somnath, like a few years after this sacking, the rebuilt temple authorities invited a Muslim trader, Niruddin Firuz of Hormuz, to settle on the temple grounds because they knew that by doing so, they would attract trade from the Middle East and this would enrich everybody. And now Somnath is they no longer trade frankincense and these like exotic lovely thing and horses like they did in those days. It's much more of a fishing spot. But it's also been a place of incredible amounts of tolerance. So
even after the sacking, you're saying they rebuilt the tolerance because of trade?
Yeah, and this is true, and I documented this as being true for medieval ports in South Asia in general, that they, even after the Europeans began to disrupt the kind of the Middle East trade networks, the norms of peace, the kind of the organizations they built up to support tolerance in those towns have actually persisted over time. And so those things seem to still operate today in interesting ways, reducing violence, as well as doing so in such a way that places where you might think there otherwise would be more violence actually tend to have less. As we were discussing, medieval ports tend to have more Muslims as a share. They tend to, Muslims tend to be richer relative to other urban Muslims, both conditions which you might think would lead to more violence, but instead they tend to be more tolerant places and with much less violence.
I want to suggest an alternative. Why wouldn't Muslims' established dominance just generate resentment? Like, why do you think people thought, well, it's in our self-interest to trade and therefore we should have that feeling? Because people can do stuff that's not good for them, right?
For sure. I think one thing I was interested in how political incentives influence these things as well. So India, because it's a subcontinent, there's places where Muslims are also politically in charge and places where they were, hardly ever ruled locally. And so, if the Mughal emperor is going to look after your interests as a Muslim, then you don't need to kind of necessarily develop these local institutions to support, trust between Hindus and Muslims. Whereas, so the places in the south of India, particularly like in Kerala, where there's hardly any Muslim rule historically, these are the places where these institutions were kind of, there's even more incentive for them to exist, and the effects on violence tended to be greater.
Oh no, that's a really interesting argument. So if you don't have top-down protection by a Mughal or Muslim overlord, then you need to develop bottom-up cooperation.
Exactly.
Because the South in general scores as much more liberal and tolerant and more open to interreligious. So I like that idea. In a sort of more anarchic situation, you've got to be nice to people.
Yeah.
If
you're doing business.
Right. Yeah. But the South in general scores as more tolerant. Okay, so here's another I hypothesis about ports. When I was in Mumbai, I think it's not just the Muslim influence, but there are so many different communities that have come there. And, there's a lot of research by Michelle Galfant, who's here at Stanford, thinking that ports and trading communities in general, because there's so much diversity, they just get used to that. So whether it's New Amsterdam or Shanghai, that in these ports, people just get used to jostling and meeting with outsiders. So maybe not necessarily a self-interested cultural thing, but hey, yeah, I've got loads of Muslim friends and we're great and we have an iftar holi thing together. Yeah. Right?
So, I think that, port towns do encourage cosmopolitanism. What was interesting, I think, to me was that if you're looking at the patterns of Hindu-Muslim violence, however, the effects of these like long-term relationships were really based on complementarities between Hindus and Muslims. And those existed in ports which existed during the times when Muslims dominated trade. So if you look at modern ports, which were created under British rule, for example, including Bombay or Madras, the East India factor who founded Madras wanted to be close to his mistress, and so he founded it there. And it doesn't have a good harbor; still doesn't. But it was these are places where they're also rich. They also have all these incentives that you mentioned, but they don't have the effect, this long term effect on reducing Hindu Muslim violence. It was really the places which emerged in the medieval period, not the modern ones, that have this relationship, largely because, you know, by, during the colonial period, you know, you had, you know, the British, the Dutch, the Portuguese were more heavily involved in doing the overseas trade. So there's a less complementarity to the Indian Muslims. Also, I think one sort of brief aside, if I
please may, go for it.
What I found very interesting is it was during the colonial period that some of these norms that Hindus began to adopt a series of norms to maintain, try to reinforce the complementarity. So there's this like a norm of kala pani that emerged called black water, that if you're a Hindu and you went over the water, the black water, you'd lose your caste. So this was, you know, this emerged during the period when sort of this complementarity between Hindus and Muslims were under threat. That, you know, when Gandhi, for example, who himself is from a medieval port, Porbandar, when he goes overseas as a lawyer to England and he has to come back and do an extensive ritual to be admitted into his caste again. So why
did the Hindus enforce that?
Well, my theory is that this is kind of another way to kind of help maintain the tolerant relationships between groups, that while there's a threat to this complementarity, you know, ultimately Hindus did go overseas, as you know, in large numbers, but there's, you know, there were sort of social norms emerging to try and keep the tolerance and the complementarity alive for a bit longer, and some of these places it was maintained for longer.
Though I wonder, continuing down the tangent, I wonder towards the sixth sense, some of it, like, you know, Kaivan Munshi's work on how jati or caste ties may slow rural urban migration. So if one person goes to the city, then we don't know if they're trustworthy, so it's better for the entire family to stay in the village. I wonder if the water thing is just the parallel, is just the water version of that, right? Let's keep everyone close because that's important for trust and cooperation.
Well, it could be. I mean, I think what's interesting is the timing, that it emerges exactly at the moment when, you know, these complementarities are under threat. And so in places where they didn't really ever exist, mostly like the modern ports, you don't see the relationships emerge, that, you know, these organizations and institutions that supported trust in quite the same way as you do. You know, so just comparing like Surat, which was the major port of the Mughal Empire going to for the Hajj, to even, you know, which also became an East India Company port, to Bombay, which is very much a kind of a colonial endeavor, you know, those relationships are very different.
Okay, I didn't know this. This is great. Okay, and I wanted to also say, what do you think of Mitra and Raj theory, Rave's theory, that Hindu-Muslim violence spiked in the 1980s because then you have Muslims coming back from doing labor migration in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, then becoming rich, and then Hindu people wanting to seize and capture that wealth through violence?
I think it's possible. I mean, I think, you know, they develop a theory where as the Muslims become richer, you know, this provides more of an incentive for Hindus to engage in violence against them, to seize their stuff.
Yes.
And, you know, that sounds plausible to me. I think that, you know, as I mentioned, in these medieval ports, what's interesting is they become as rich as Hindus if you look at the wealth distribution, but there's less violence. And so I think that, and those places are also heavily exposed to the Middle East today. They have those connections going back to kind of to medieval times. So I think that there might be some truth to what they're saying, but it's also very conditional on the local institutions, which, you know, can moderate the way that people allow groups from, you know, other groups to become wealthy or not.
I'm with you. Okay, but here's a question. So in your theory, as I understand it, it's sort of that economic incentives drive culture. Like, if there's an economic incentive for trade and complementarity, then we'll be nice to each other. But I wonder about the power of storytelling and vilification. Mm-hmm. So like in the 17th century, you know, Hindus were mobilized to rise up against the Mughals under the Maratha Empire, right? And that was about storytelling. Yeah. That was saying, you know, let's take on these people. Let's, you know, there's a quote, I forget it, from Shivaji. It's like, you know, we can only be free if we claim our freedom, something like that. I mean, in the early 20th century, there's this nice book by Gupta all about Hindu publicists spreading alleged, you know, rumors of love jihad. There's a book that came out recently by Kunal Prohit on Hindu pop stars, individual pop stars. So all these people are like, they're telling stories. Yeah. And like that hatred seems to be about storytelling. It's about like love jihad or population growth. And I wonder how important that culture or that portrayal of people as the enemy or as dangerous threats comes into violence rather than economic incentives.
I mean, I'm not saying that those things don't have a role. I think what's also important is how fertile the ground they fall on is. And so, like, I think Somnath, for example, is a good example, because this is one of those big narratives that exists. And so, for example, when L.K. Advani, the former BJP leader, wanted to kind of, some would argue, wanted to sort of make Hindu identity salient in opposition to Islam, he begins his Rath Yatra from Somnath, this pilgrimage around India, but it begins at Somnath because of this kind of, it's seen as this Kosovo-Polje moment where, in history, where hatreds were created. But as we kind of discussed, Somnath itself and those other medieval ports nearby don't have that, don't have that, even though those are the messages being propagated in a big way around that, right? Mm. So similarly, I mean, we were talking about North-South. In the South, I mean, in Kerala, as you know, there's the Mapela Rebellion, which occurred in the colonial period, which was where there's extensive Hindu-Muslim violence happening in the villages. But, the port towns which were surrounding the violence happened right next to these port towns where there's very little violence.
Oh, really?
And so these big narratatives of hatreds can, they land on fertile ground.
Some people listen more than others.
Yeah,
okay,
exactly.
I'm with you. Okay, now reflecting on your theory more broadly, I want to ask you some other sort of questions about change over time. So why do you think Hindu-Muslim massacres, in terms of like big horrific killings, why do you think those seem to have fallen in recent decades?
Mm-hmm. So so Stephen Wilkinson and I did a project trying to understand the determinants of ethnic cleansing during the partition of South Asia, which I think is kind of the big one. let's be honest.
Yes,
and
yes.
More than some estimate, it's like 1 million people might have been killed. 3.5 million went missing.
Yeah.
During that period of targeted minorities.
Yes,
And I think the things that came out of that study were interesting. One of them was, you needed to have local organizational capacity, in order to do things at large scale.
Yes.
And, so during the partition of South Asia, I think people thought that really this elementary school intuition that, two kids aren't playing well together, it's good to separate them, would work. And this was seen as a viable political compromise, but it really deteriorated into a disaster, a series of massacres.
Mm.
And I don't think they anticipated that.
Mm.
I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that, in our paper, we find that there's a lot of relationship with the veterans from World War II who had come back, and many of them had developed skills that could challenge, the protecting forces. And, these skills don't make you a better insurance salesperson, but they help you protect your own people, sometimes at the expense of others. So during the partition in particular, there was this sort of legacy of World War II that was important. But there was also the extent to which it was violent also differed, again, by the local institutions. So where, Muslims were close to, where they wanted to change the facts on the ground, where Muslims were closer to the Hindu population in India, and Hindus were closer to the Muslim population in Pakistan, that's where you got more violence. In the medieval ports, again, you get less violence, even though they have relatively more Muslims. So I think part of it is the political incentives, but also another thing I think that was important about partition was this idea of the homeland, that, one reason why you might engage in violence if you are competing with someone is to get rid of them.
Yes.
And it's easier to get rid of them if it's perceived that there's another place for them to go.
Mm-hmm.
If they can't go anywhere, you get into a war of attrition, and it's going to be costly for both sides. So I think the perception that it's easier to get rid of minorities by making them move somewhere else, I think that's also changed over time.
But so if we come back to, say, the past 15 years, because
mm-hmm.
I think, over the past 15 years, there's been a decrease in killings, in massacres, but an increase in voting for the BJP.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, those trends are kind of opposite, in a sense. Like, why don't they go together?
So I don't think the voting for the BJP is necessarily done mostly on this issue.
Oh, really?
Anymore.
Okay.
I think in Gujarat in 2002, I did my field work there shortly thereafter, and I think, you know, there were, of course, mass riots, and you know, 1,000 people, mostly Muslims, were killed, 98,000 forced into refugee camps. I mean, that was a situation where, you know, there was a snap snap election immediately afterwards. And I think that, you know, this platform was crucial. You know, you see a big swing towards the BJP in places where Hindus and Muslims are competing. And then you see a swing against the BJP in the medieval ports. But I think if you look at the kind of the trajectory of the BJP after 2002, particularly our current prime minister, you know, the platform really changes. And, it, you know, I have a theory that has something to do with the fact that the medieval ports then became marginal constituencies in the next election. And they wanted to, you know, this anti-Muslim rhetoric wasn't very popular there. Instead, they wanted to have a pro-business type of relationship. And so his platform became really about sabke saath, sabke vikas, you know, everybody together for the benefit of everyone. He was actually accused by members of his own party of being no longer the Hindu Hriday Samrat, the emperor of human Hindu hearts, because he wasn't espousing this type of platform. So I think, you know, part of it is that that kind of the people who are motivated by those types of things are probably going to vote for the BJP anyway. So how do you capture the rest of the population by having a much more moderate platform, focusing on development and sort of growth rather than on sort of these types of animosities? So I think that really explains this difference to some extent.
But like, so for example, okay, here's another question. Do you think over the past 30 years, Indian society has become more or less competitive?
Competitive?
Well, competitive in your sense that, you know, if you have competition, then you might see more conflict. Mm-hmm. Like, do you think competition has increased?
So, I'd need to look at the data. I mean, I've looked at snapshots, mm-hmm. and, you know, there's definitely kind of variation from place to place. But one interesting thing about the theory is, as you get thicker markets, you know, if you have a really big market where, you know, there's thousands of Hindus doing the same thing and, you know, thousands of Muslims doing the same thing, but fewer, you know, the effects of Muslims competing with Hindus are going to be pretty small because there's so many other
competitors. So economic growth might be seen as reducing competition. Oh, but here's another way of looking at it. So, for example, as you know, as university enrollment increases, and also in India, I'd say India probably has the most competition in the world in terms of university places, and especially the government civil service exam, mm-hmm. right? There's a major, major form of competition. Like, you go down any Indian street and you'll see all these adverts for private tuition. There's even a nice paper suggesting that women take time off when their kids are in grade 10 mm-hmm. to help them with their tuition, right? It's a really, really big thing. Yep. Lots of people want a government job. I was in Rajasthan. Everyone says they want a government job. So I would see that as a major, major form of competition. And as everyone becomes more educated, but the state does not expand, then that competition becomes tighter.
Yeah.
So you might predict that competition would be leading to more conflict, but we also know that very few Muslims clear those exams, right? So Muslims tend to be poorer, they tend mm-hmm. to be less successful mm-hmm. in those examinations. So that, to me, would suggest that the competition is not against Muslims. Mm-hmm. Like, the Muslims aren't the major competitor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet, if we look at the RSS, Shiv Sena, for example, mm-hmm. or so much of this rhetoric,
mm-hmm.
you see a huge amount of Islamophobia, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem to be so closely linked to economic competition. Like, I'm saying, you know, there is economic competition. It's not obviously about Muslims, but yet we see this massive Islamophobia. So how would you interpret that from your theory?
Yeah, let me first say
that,
you know, there's sort of different types of competition.
Yes.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there's, you know, political competition and, you know, places where, you know, where there's sort of competition for rents,
yes.
as you're mentioning. You know, there are still places where Muslims and Hindus are competing for those rents. And it's probably not in the civil service exams, but it's in other domains, and, you know, including electing MPs who have different types of views on who should get, you know, some of the gains from office.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also economic competition in some places. The Hindus and Muslims today still compete in, you know, in urban areas for things like land, for things like, you know, oftentimes they're in the same professions or similar professions. So
are they really like that? And you've seen that work by Paul Novosad and Sam Asher, and like Muslims' educational mobility has worsened.
Yeah.
Muslims are predominantly poor. You know, even though scheduled classes have done much, much better.
Yeah.
Like, Muslims tend to be in poor areas, and there's a new paper by Paul Novosad and Sam Asher showing that Muslim areas tend to be underserviced, you know, having fewer public goods, fewer schools, fewer electricity, everything, everything worse.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it doesn't look like, and there's massive discrimination in terms of housing.
Mm-hmm.
So given so much under provision of public goods and discrimination, like, I would have thought the everyday person trying to make it is not, like, in the economic competition for labour markets, it's not obvious that the Muslim man is your major competitor.
No, I agree. I mean, and so I think the both of those, I think that locally, that can be the case still. I think globally, you know, I agree. I mean, in fact, I think part of the story is that other groups have had more, you know, other, you know, caste groups are you know, have protections from the constitution.
Yes, yes.
You know, from law, and so they have more access. And so there's a lot of, you know, caste has been, you know, ever since the Mundell Commission, if not earlier, has this big political content, which is, you know, and it does lead to the dynamics that you're describing. At the same time, you know, I think that there's, you know, I think that there's sort of a situation where you have like local institutions and local incentives, which are interacting with sort of these broader political incentives or broader political things. And so this has happened historically. You know, you can see in places where Muslims have been, you know, Stephen Wilkinson's work, where he shows that where Muslims are sort of part of a, you need them to form the winning coalition in the government at the state level, you get less violence and less of this rhetoric against Muslims. But it's when they, you don't need them, that, you know, that they're, that you get more of it, right? So, you know, I think we're in a world where, you know, it's useful to kind of foment these things to as part of the nation building project that the kind of the current government is focusing on, that to recreate what it means to be an Indian.
Yes,
to some extent,
for sure. Okay, so let me also think. So if you picture in your head the sort of the map of the electoral map, like, you know, BJP being strong in the Hindu heartland, right, north central India, right, but less strong in the south. To me, that's largely predicted by culture. Like Pew data, the Pew research, they've got all this data, like, to be a true Indian, you should be a Hindu, you should speak Hindi, a true Hindu should not eat veg, should be veg, right? Mm-hmm. All these sorts of cultural beliefs about Hindu nationalism and about very strong prohibitions against inter-religious marriage strongly, strongly map on to BJP voting. Right? It's people in Uttar Pradesh and Bihar who've got those very, very strong beliefs about cow protection, about interreligious marriages, is about who counts as a true Indian.
Well, Bihar is still bucking that a bit. I mean, you know, support for Nitish Kumar and that, you know, it's, I wouldn't say that it's, I mean, I see what you're
saying. Let me show you, look. So I'll show you on my laptop. So these are the Pew map, sorry for the listeners, I'll show you. So like being a Hindu is very important to be a truly Indian. Like it's much, much stronger, much higher in the north and also in some of those.
Yeah, so I mean, in the east, it's lower though, right? I mean,
yes, it's lower in the east and it's lower in the south.
So that's where Bihar is.
So all these what?
As someone from Bihar, I need to.
But wait, like religion is very important. Like, so I also find interesting is it's not just about Hindu nationalism, but people in Bihar and Uttar Pradesh also seem to have stronger prohibitions on inter-caste marriage, like what they say to the Pew research. Mm-hmm. So societies that seem to be culturally tight in general, they seem to predominate in the north, central, and also in the west, and they just tend to vote more for the BJP. Right. Like that map seems pretty similar.
Yeah, but again, you know, Bihar's not.
Okay.
There,
wait, I can, yes.
It's in the east.
Yeah. Yes. But like a lot of these things, a percentage of Indians who'd say they'd be willing to accept a Muslim as a neighbor. So north, central, okay. So it's the South that emerges as much, much more progressive and liberal and open. Like for me, the big thing to explain is not necessarily those medieval ports, but why is the South so much more open and liberal in general? Right. So I'm with you, fine, that Bihar Fine, you get your Bihar points. No, I have a lot of affinity. I had a wonderful time in Patna and Madhubani, yeah. So I have a lot of love for Bihar. But yeah, to me...
Yeah, Madhubani painting.
Oh, yes. Oh, it's glorious. For listeners, yes, I got a Madhubani painting as well. Glorious, and I love it. But for me, the big outlier is the South. Yeah. Right? So on all this attitudinal data, the South mm-hmm. scores as much more open and liberal on everything, not just religion, but also intercaste marriages, etc. I mean, I'm not saying that the South is more liberal on every dimension, but in terms of like these Hindu nationalist identities, that seems to be the big thing to explain.
I think, yeah, I mean, of course, I think we both agree there's a lot of variation
yes.
in all of these.
Yes, yes,
regions.
Of course. Of course. India's a big place and there's a huge amount of subnational heterogeneity in every single state.
So I mean, you know, there's the South is also pretty affluent. It's, you know, it has been, you know, Malabar, I mean, it comes from the word for bridge because it was the bridge between the Indian Ocean and trade more generally. So, I mean, I think trade still plays an important role in those stories. I think there's a number of features there. It's also, you're the expert on sort of the spread of Islam in India and other things. I mean, there's a different history there as well, right? So, in the South, a lot of Islamic conversion happened through Sufi saints. Eaton has and Susan Bailey have work on, have the agricultural frontier played an important role in these patterns as well. So I think these historical legacies are also make a difference relative to, being competing for patronage, as was the case in a lot of northern India.
Yes.
Over time, because you think about northern Indian cities. Many of them were founded by Muslims, and it was Hindus and Muslims competing for patronage from Muslim overlords. Whereas in the South, there was a different type, the conversion happened through trade, it happened through, the extension of agriculture through the Sufi saints and so on and so forth. So I think those histories also matter as well. I think history matters.
Yes,
I think
I'm with you. Though I'll tell you. I've recently been reading on Muslims in Bangladesh and also in Bangladesh specifically. Many of these Sufi peers are actually losing predominance because now they're being cast out of the way as being not properly Muslim, and people moving towards more Salafist ideas. So that's an example of change. Here's a question for you: if economic cooperation is really important for peaceful cooperation, as with the case of me and The Economist, what do you recommend? Like, what would be the Sumitra Jha peace strategy? Like, how can you promote cooperation? Like, I would have thought that economic growth would be a great example. As you said, the more jobs, more complementarities. Mm-hmm. So what would be your strategy? Like, if you had infinite money, what would work to promote cooperation from an economic perspective?
So I think the first thing is to think, to recognize that, when ethnicities and competition coincide, that's going to lead to more tension.
Mm.
And so one way to think about it is how can we channel it's the case in much of the world that, where you're from, your background really can shape your economic opportunities. Now, can we think about ways to leverage that such that you can kind of create complementarities in new ways? And the answer is yes. I mean, there's, for example, the Ismaili community in East Africa have these industrial promotion services where they match Ismailis and non-Ismailis into joint business ventures. Mm-hmm. So that's one idea. I think another idea that I've been very interested in is how you can use financial ideas to bring people together, because, finance is really about sharing the future in a credible way. And if you can sort of do that in a way that leverages complementarity and frankly our shared risks are really high right now. I mean, if we don't solve this climate problem, for example, we're all going to be in severe problems, and this is particularly the case in India with the environment and other things. So there's a lot of reasons why we can sort of leverage economic ideas, financial ideas.
Could you give me a concrete example of how you'd promote peaceful corporate, like, how do you encourage Indian Hindus and Muslims to see themselves as allies, as people who can help each other and benefit from each other's learning and ideas?
So I think, you know, if I may, I'll give an analogy rather, because I need to think about how to apply this. But one case I've been really interested in is actually Meiji Japan, where, you know, you have this samurai caste, which is fine. You know, the caste system was even more entrenched than the Indian caste system. You, the samurai were 5% of the population. They were had a monopoly over the right to bear arms and violence. And they were the biggest potential losers from reforms. And so the kind of the Meiji reformers, actually learning from American Hamilton's example and that of Britain, they took their traditional rice stipends and instead they gave them bonds, government Japan bonds, and they allowed them to use those bonds to capitalize banks.
Mm-hmm.
So the number of banks in Japan went from 3 to 150 in a 3-year period. And you know, suddenly you had these were long-lived banks, some of them still exist, you know, where samurai, you know, ex-samurai were invested with non-samurai, and they were all invested in, like, the local silk merchants, the local cotton merchants. If you're, or at the kind of, at the bigger level, like the really rich samurai, they got to invest in this Kozoku Bank, where they invested in national railway projects and things which brought the country together. Mm-hmm. And so you can see that, you know, over time, the distinctions between samurai and non-samurai really diminished. I mean, just like in Britain, you know, when Napoleon calls Britain a nation of shopkeepers, he has a kind of a point, because the distinctions between the country and the city, which were kind of much more established in France and elsewhere, are really kind of diminished in Britain. And so I think that kind of bringing people together through financial means, where they can share in the future together, where they can share the risks of ethnicity together, can really have this effect. And this could be done in potentially in India as well. I think the details need to be, it has to be done carefully. And so I don't want to kind of propose like a full agenda, but I think there's lots to be learned from these historical examples where you've undermined ethnicity as a kind of a touchstone of politics while bringing people together in economic relationships such that they, you know, they're no longer in conflict with one another. I think it has an immense potential.
Okay, so I don't know if you've seen this wonderful paper by Pavithra Suryanayan at the LSE, and she argues that after the Mandel Commission, the BJP, upper castes worried about, actually tried to hollow out the state and supported right-wing parties for that reason, because they didn't want to contribute to public goods. So I think in an endogamous society where upper caste people want to maintain their status, they may be reluctant to contributing to those nation-building institutions. But yeah, I think it's the important question. I think it's the important question. Like, if cooperation is really important, one, how do you get people to perceive each other as allies? And I think it's just about the economics, but it's also, for example, one thing we see is, like, you know, not to go on my own hobby horse, but control over women, right? If love jihad is so central, and that's only going to become more important, because we know that India has historically had this major son bias and there's declining fertility, which means that in 20 years, many Indian men will struggle to get wives. Yeah. So I would predict, you know, going with your theory, competition over women is going to become more intense, because you'll have surplus men, fewer women. So who is getting those women is going to be a major, major issue.
That sounds like a recipe for...
It's not a good recipe, yes. Yes. But anyway, this has been a total, total pleasure. So thank you very much, Professor Sumitra Jha, for your time.
Thanks so much, Professor Evans. It's been such a delight.
Thank you. Okay, perfect.